welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones, and now, perhaps, just maybe, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon, HBO's new Game of Thrones prequel. This, Aaron, is going to be a podcast where we talk about that very show, House of the Dragon, everything we know about it. We're going to kind of sum it up. There's been a little bit of info that has come out, about the production, the state of production, some casting news. We kind of have a basic timeline of when this story is going to take place in the Game of Thrones or, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire universe. So we're going to kind of go over what we do know so far. I did want to say before we get started, though, that a big thank you to Anthony, who has been doing the Electric Boogaloo podcast for the last two seasons. It's been like five months, mm-hmm, maybe. Mm-hmm. Kind of keeping the feed warm for us here as we transition from Game of Thrones to House of the Dragon. You're probably going to see a lot of changes in 2022 as we get closer to the show, to this particular feed. But this will be the podcast where we will do all of our coverage of House of the Dragon. So if you are subscribed to this podcast, stay subscribed to it. If you're going to be watching House of the Dragon, we'll be talking about everything House of the Dragon right here.
Yeah, but the art and the title and the music might shift to reflect the House of the Dragon more than the Game of Thrones.
You got to get that organic search traffic, man. You got to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're dead.
Yeah. You got to. And we're going to be talking about a lot. We're going to talk about what we know about it, what we know of the history, what we know of the casting and characters, the filming locations. And we're going to also talk a little bit meta, because obviously there's some mixed emotions, some mixed feelings around the Game of Thrones franchise, Song of Ice and Fire franchise.
You've heard our podcast around the end of Game of Thrones season 8, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But there's also reason to be kind of optimistic and hopeful about that. And it's, you know, what the audience is going to do with it's interesting. But it's also been frustrating because, you know, Game of Thrones ended and there was all these plans. There was going to be first they greenlit a series that was going to be set in like prehistory of Game of Thrones, like right when the wall was being built and the White Walkers were first walking. And
I was kind of excited about that.
Yeah, that kind of got shit canned. And then we heard some like, well, it's going to be some Duncan Egg stuff. That's kind of a popular series that George Martin's written a lot of short stories and some comic book installments. And then that got, and then now we got this House of the Dragon, which I don't know. Maybe George writing the Fire and Blood Volume 1 history, which about half of that deals with this time period. Mm-hmm. And also, Anthony, speaking of Anthony, we did a 3-part deep dive into Volume 1 of Fire and Blood back 2 years ago. And a lot of the material, the historical material, if you want to check it out, about the Dance of the Dragons, because that's what this era of Game of Thrones or in the Song of Ice and Fire universe is widely called. Like, you know, Game of Thrones was set during or after the period of Robert's Rebellion. You know, you've also heard of like the Blackfyre Rebellion, perhaps Aegon's conquering. This is the Dance of the Dragons, which is a pretty storied history of Game of Thrones, the universe, the Westeros universe, and really did a lot to weaken the stranglehold that the Targaryens had on the continent of Westeros. It's a tragic civil war with lots of twists and turns. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of the big beats. You know, if you go to a Wiki of Ice and Fire or World of Ice and Fire, again, Fire and Blood, you'll see kind of like a, you know, like in history when you read about the different battles of World War II or the Civil War. But like those books as well, a lot of the characters are kind of thin. You know, they did this thing and for maybe this reason, but what were their motivations? What was their background? What were their loyalties? Mm-hmm. Those things are kind of like not really dealt with, not deep dives. And that's the stuff that really makes Game of Thrones pop, right? The intrigue,
for sure.
The backstabbing, the ancient rivalries. So there's still a lot, even though we know a lot about this. And this is a complete story. We know how it ends. I think there's still a lot of room for mystery and intrigue, this kind of stuff that draws Game of Thrones fans to this.
Well, and the time period, specifically this Dance of Dragons, everything, you know, both leading up to it and then the aftermath of it. I'm kind of all in after reading a little bit about this backstory, because mm-hmm. it has a lot of the same beats as something like a Game of Thrones, right? The War of the Five Kings. I get a very similar vibe. I see where you could introduce a lot of intrigue, a lot of, like, you know, the stuff with Littlefinger and just all the mm-hmm. scheming behind the scenes, the political stuff. I really get, like, a vision in my head of what this could be when I think about the events that are going to happen and what people's motivations might be.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, you'll find it much, you know, it'll feel very familiar.
Yes.
Because the political system is very similar to the time of Game of Thrones. It's only a couple hundred years before. You still got King's Landing. You still got the Hand of the King. You still got the Master of Whispers. There's still a Stark sitting in Winterfell.
Kingsguard sort of thing.
You got Kingsguard, you've got the Gold Cloaks, you've got a lot of the institutions, Dragonstone, where the ancestral seat of the Targaryens and where the heir to the throne traditionally sits with their dragons, that's all in play. So there's got to be a lot of locations and offices that feel familiar, you know, like, but you know, if you did a House of Cards, right? That's Kevin Spacey, modern day scheming. You could do a House of Cards, you know, 1860, and you'd still have whips, house whips, sure. You'd still have speakers, and you'd still have the vice president, president. It'd feel surprisingly familiar to modern audiences. So I think we're going to get a lot of that crossover. Should we talk about just, you know, we got some official material and we've curbed some notes from that. The big picture, what this is about, according to HBO, is this is going to be based on that volume one of Fire and Blood. Volume two still has not been published yet. Mm-hmm. And it's going to tell the story of House Targaryen, the house that gave us Dany, Daenerys Targaryen, the mother of dragons. It's going to take place. The press notes consistently say 300 years before the events of Game of Thrones. Now, there's two possibilities, because that's just wrong. Like, from a historical Game of Thrones nerd standpoint, no, that's not how it happens.
With these particular 300 years before,
300 years before Game of Thrones is when Aegon the Conqueror conquered Westeros with his enormous dragons and his two badass sisters, and the Seven Kingdoms became united under one central rule in King's Landing.
Yeah.
That's what happened 300 years, and that is not the story that we're getting. The story that we're getting takes place, you know, Aegon's conquering was so pivotal that they renamed. This was kind of like Jesus mm-hmm. Christ being born. You had BC before the conquering and AC after the conquering. So Aegon was coronated and named king at the year zero of Aegon's conquering, or year one or whatever. This takes place between 103 and 129 AC. So it's about 200 years before Game of Thrones. I do not know whether this is just a mistake and left over some notes of a previous adaptation, or whether they're hinting that they are going to take a lot more liberties with the property than we know of.
Oh, or the third option maybe is they're going to do some kind of prelude with Aegon's conquest stuff a little bit maybe, but I can't see that lasting more than like an introductory portion of episode one, right?
Totally agree. Although, I mean, we'll talk about this as we go on, because some of the casting news and stuff, like, you know, might not make sense, or like how pivotal a character depending on where, but like, you know, maybe there's a whole season of build up to where you get to know these characters and there's some flashbacks and stuff before like the thing that actually incites this stuff actually happens. Do we want to get in? And I've got like a little bit of material, like a deep dive into the background of the story. It doesn't get into the story itself. And, you know, just like any history report, there's going to be some light spoilers. If you want to be completely unspoiled for House of Dragons, you honestly shouldn't listen to any of the podcasts or look at anything on Twitter or Reddit or any of that kind of stuff. Because, again, there's a lot of material. Hundreds and hundreds of pages have already been written about these events and these characters.
And as we get closer to 2022, if you really want to stay spoiler free, you're going to have to do like Martin. You're going to have to hole up in a cabin. You're not going to be able to be on the Internet.
This is going to be Star Wars and Marvel big, even with a minor disappointment or major disappointment of how Game of Thrones ended. This is still going to be huge, huge, huge entertainment news. So the backstory to House of the Dragon, we've got King Viserys I, who is the fifth Targaryen king after Aegon to sit on the Iron Throne. He ruled, as I mentioned, between 103 to 129 AC. He succeeded his grandfather, was called the Old King, Jaehaerys, because he just lived forever and is a very wise, benevolent king. Viserys continued the prosperous peace and legacy of his grandsire, and in fact left the kingdom more well off and prosperous than ever. The coffers, like, you know, Robert's rebellion was a big time of upheaval, and Robert was kind of not paying attention, and the kingdom's kind of being laid like robbed blind, and there wasn't a lot saved up for winter. This is not that situation. This is a kingdom that's well-founded that just is going to fall to shit. he's also notable for being the last rider of Balerion, the Black Dread. This is the massive black battle dragon that Aegon himself rode into battle and finally succumbed to old age. And in the king's old age, a dragon died. He never took another dragon as a dragon rider. He had three children by his first queen, Aemma Arryn, but only one of them survived to adulthood, his daughter, Princess Rhaenyra. So he didn't have a son to succeed him. And because of that, even though there was several precedents set in the years before that, you know, women get skipped over, the hereditary throne passes through the male lineage, he decided, fuck all that. I got a daughter. I'm going to put all my interest into her. So he began to train her to be the heir. She was included in discussions about the matters of state, allowed to participate in the small council meetings. And that was kind of controversial, but a lot of nobles took note. And she started getting some bands of adherents and admirers because she's a formidable woman. Yeah,
started lining up
right
behind the next queen, right?
Right. And after his queen, Aemma, passed in 105 AC, Viserys named Rhaenyra his heir, and had hundreds of the lords and ladies of Westeros file through, bend the knee to her as the acknowledged heir to his throne. And then a year later, he remarried. And a lot of it is put because the Hand of the King was this Otto Hightower, which we're going to talk about. And he nominated his daughter to make time with the aging king. A lot of people said that, like, he kind of overstepped his bounds. He was, like, maybe following his own interest, but that's what happened. And they had four more children, three of them males, strong, strapping, dragon riding Targaryen males. And you can probably already see the seeds of a problem here. Rivalry soon developed between the princess and the queen. In fact, in 111 AC, there's this big tourney that they often hold in King's Landing. For the fifth anniversary of Viserys's marriage to this Alicent Hightower. And during the opening feast, the queen wore this brilliant green gown, while the princess Rhaenyra wore the a gown of black and red, the traditional Targaryen colors. And then from that point forward, people started being called themselves as the Greens or the Blacks, based on whether you favored the old king and his queen, or whether you favored the princess. Whose you were allied to. At this time, the king, he'd grown old and kind of complacent. He did not see any of this danger of his court splitting in two. He did not bother to redo any of the succession planning. And the king died in his sleep a little bit later. The queen, again, the Hightower queen, Alicent Hightower, instead of, like, you're supposed to, like, ring the bells, start the succession in King's Landing to the new queen. Instead, she sealed the king's body in his chambers, threw all the servants who knew about the death into the black cells, called an emergency small council meeting with her father, the Hand, expressly saying, how are we going to solve this matter of succession? And all the other lords are like, well, it's settled. It's Princess Rhaenyra. What the hell's going on? Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the wee hours of the morning, some of the council members started murmuring that this is treason. The master of coin stood up and said he wasn't going to be a part of this anymore. And the commander of the King's Guard stabbed him, killed him, who was known to have a personal grudge against Princess Rhaenyra. And at this point, once, you know, blood was spilt, there started to be a swift consensus to build around naming Viserys's oldest son Aegon. Strong name. Aegon II. Sounds sure. good. Got a nice ring to it. Naming him to the throne. Aegon didn't want the throne. He thought this was a bunch of bullshit and thought this was double dealing with his stepsister, or I guess his half-sister. But his mother and the Hand of the King convinced him, and this has actually probably got some truth to it, that like as the king's legitimate firstborn male heir, you are always going to be a political rival to your sister, because anytime she steps wrong, the lords are going to be like, hey, you know what? We got the male heir here and you could build a rebellion against it. So they convinced him that if he didn't take the kingship and renounce his sister, that she would just kill him anyway. So he reluctantly took the heir, the kingship, the crown. And then his brother Aemon, then flew off on his large battle dragon to bring, you know, like this dragon diplomacy flying around the Seven Kingdoms. Like, hey, we're changing up the succession. Make sure everybody's cool with it. The princess, for her, part was over on Dragonstone, the ancestral seat of the Targaryens, where the heir apparent traditionally dwelled while the king was ruling in King's Landing. Learned of her father's death and of her step parents and half brother's treason, called her own Black Council that included Daemon, which was her uncle and one of the realm's most dangerous men. We're going to talk about him pretty soon. Corlys Velaryon, the sea snake, the greatest mariner of his generation, who commanded the largest fleet. But that's pretty much all of her political power. You know, she had that and her teenage sons. But what she did have is a shit ton of dragons. She and her court had 6 large battle-ready dragons, 6 trained and experienced dragon riders, with Dragonstone itself having 6 more large dragons, some of them feral, just chilling out in the caves and the cliffs. But they had, like, you know, dragons in the garage ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
King Aegon only had 4 dragons. So... while it's good to have air power and air superiority, you also need men and armies to hold that territory. So Princess Rhaenyra's goal is to also start some dragon diplomacy, send her teenage sons to go around to, like, especially the Arryns and the Baratheons and Stormlands to try to get them to pledge fealty and support, while King Daemon and the Queen Mother was trying to solidify their power under the green party, and cut off his half sister before she could establish her rule. This resulted in a civil war that raged through the realm for 3 years, became later known as the Dance of Dragons. It will end in large swaths of the Seven Kingdoms being burnt to the ground. It will nearly ruin the House Targaryen. Many dragons and dragon riders will die during this war. A House Targaryen will see its stable of dragons dwindle to just a handful of surviving beasts. I saw some source that said 2, some that said 4, but they were counting like a wild dragon that killed anyone to try to sit on him and some other things. And they had just like maybe 6 surviving Targaryens too. The dragons never recovered. Like, this is the time where the dragon eggs stopped hatching. They started hatching stunted and deformed, dying very young. The Targaryens never recovered from this. And, you know, a couple generations later, the Blackfyre Rebellion will all but finish them off. And then they'll be easy pluckings for Robert's Rebellion just a few generations after that. So just 300 years after Aegon, for the first time, conquered ever all 7 kingdoms, for the Targaryens, they're going to lose it all. And this is where it all begins. So I think, like we said, it's a great setting for the storytelling, because you're going to recognize almost all the houses and all the big players, the Starks, the Arryns, the Lannisters. And unlike the Song of Ice and Fire series, where we had novelizations and people's POV chapters and their innermost thoughts, this is all just kind of like a historical framework. And we know the big beats of the war, but we don't know all that, like, really interesting, all the intrigue stuff, all the personal relationships aren't as well sketched. So there's going to be lots of room to speculate and theorize about what's going to come. Some room for surprising twists and intrigue and high drama, and also some stuff that might inform our understanding of the later series, too. So, again, if you want to hear more, me and Anthony did a 3-part deep dive into Fire and Blood, and the second and third installments are essentially all about the Dance of Dragons. So
I want to do
that. Is the background
a little bit of speculation and then diving into some of that stuff a bit here real quick, because reading through this, listening to you talk about it, a few things come to mind where, mm-hmm. I see the marks of all the things about House Targaryen that they had talked about in the show, Game of Thrones, things from like, the Targaryens are known as sort of like an incestuous bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like there's going to be some of that because Daemon is actually not just Rhaenyra's uncle, he's also her husband. Is that right?
So she gets married, I think, 3 different times. And I think, yes, he is her second husband.
So there's definitely going to be some of that.
And King Aegon II immediately married his sister upon taking the Iron Throne. So, yeah,
there
tons. I don't know why. I don't know why this is such a hallmark of Game of Thrones and George Martin, but yes, we have a lot of incest boxes.
The whatever amount of incest you were icked out by in Game of Thrones, double it, and then probably double it again for this. Who knows?
And this is just feudal societies, too. This is the pharaohs did it. The kings of Europe did it. Cousin, sister, uncle fucking rife.
Yeah, happens all the time. The other thing I'm interested in is like this war seems like a very short time period. This civil war you're talking about that raged for quote unquote 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at Game of Thrones, I see the time spans being much larger than that. And if this show is only going to span the Civil War, I mean, maybe they can, dilate the time a little bit and dig mm-hmm. in deeper to those moments and not have, months pass while people are traveling on a road. That's hard to do, though, because, I guess with dragons, it's a little bit easier.
Break out
the jetpacks. Yeah, they've got them in storage. We know it. I'm curious to see how they're going to handle the timing of everything.
I think you've got some hints here because you've got 20 plus dragons, the jumbo jets mm-hmm. and a military attack aircraft of their time, where these characters can literally just fly around the Seven Kingdoms pretty quick. And the Sea Snake character, known for his swift sailing, that's another way that they were kind of able to blur timelines late in the series when they started getting
like Euron,
the Euron Greyjoy and his fleet doing this. Like he's on this side of Westeros, he's on that side of Westeros, he's across the narrow sea. You can kind of fudge with air and sea power, and it looks like they've got all that stuff built in, even more than you had in the original series.
And I'm also wondering what the state of dragon defense would be, because you've got a scenario in which the Targaryens rule the land kind of united, right? What would the need be for cities with dragon defense, right? They're not going to have these ballistas necessarily.
Well, they even,
it's a lot of dragon to dragon fighting, right?
Right. And there's a lot of just thrilling, like dragon to dragon aerial combat
stuff.
That's going to be pretty glorious to watch. I mean, it is kind of silly that, like, because they made it a big deal, like ballistas, like it's an unknown technology, it's a big dragon spear. But I don't know. I mean, it also would make sense if Aegon just banned the research into any kind of anti-air defense, because why would he want his family's only form of superiority to be weakened? So like maybe there's 300 years of just enforced ignorance about this kind of thing.
And the other thing from that time period, maybe you can clue me in a little bit on this. So I know that the Dornish are the only kingdom that resisted. Was it Aegon when he came over and conquered Westeros?
Yeah, their house words are unbent, unbroken, unbowed. They're the one house that didn't bend the knee. Yeah.
So they would have a lot of that tech, I imagine. They have to fight off a lot of dragons. So yeah, I'm curious what role Dorne might play in any of this stuff that's going
to
be happening.
That'd be interesting, because I don't think they've been brought to the fold at this point. They're still like the kingdom in rebellion.
Right. We'll see.
But I could be wrong. Maybe Jaehaerys did make peace there. But we want to talk about the production of this. Talk about the showrunners, the writers, reasons for us to be excited, because as far as I know, the Double D's are not involved in this project.
Yeah.
I will say that like whoever's adapting this material is going to has an easier job, because you don't got just bullet points. You got a whole fucking encyclopedia, mm-hmm. and part one of a history tome to go off of. So like there shouldn't be any kind of horseshit about like the ending being flubbed or whatever. The only thing you can do is make it cooler by adding more layers to the sympathies and the alliances and the backgrounds. It should just like the action itself is pretty fucking cool. Mm-hmm. If there's actual characters that we care about and feel for and don't want to see hurt, and then it's just going to get better. So up front, George Martin is credited as co-creator. He says House of Dragon has been in development for several years. It's actually the first concept I pitched to HBO when we started talking about a successor show way back in the summer of 2016. I don't know if I believe that, because I don't know that George always shoots straight with what he says to the fans.
Sure.
And it's hard to believe that like this is the fourth iteration of the prequel if it's the first thing that he suggested, because it's, I think, one of the things I talked about. Like, I'm like, oh, you could do the Blackfyre Rebellion. You could certainly do the Dance of Dragons. And then I heard, oh, prequel series set 3,000 years in Game of Thrones prehistory. And I'm like, yeah, OK, well, that's wild. Or Dunkin' Egg. Like, OK, that's an odd part. That'd be like doing a Last Airbender follow up. And it's I don't know, Aang before, when he's a little kid, you know, just going around having adventures and stuff. I'm like, all right. But like this is a very fleshed out, even before Fire and Blood and all this stuff. Like, this is a fairly legendary. There was already a couple short stories. I think The Princess and the Queen, where Martin had laid a lot of groundwork on this. And it's also, you know, was mentioned in passing in the show and in the books. Like, you know, they talk about this like it's World War One, because it kind of is. Blackfyre Rebellion's World War Two. And this, and then I don't know what the fuck Robert's Rebellion's World War Three, but
yeah. One of the other people involved in this is the showrunner, who's going to be one of the biggest creative forces aside from Martin. And that's going to be Ryan Condal, who is actually the showrunner on Colony. It's kind of a small sci-fi show. I think it was on, I don't remember the network, but it was run by Carlton Cuse. He was the co, he was one of the co-creatives on that, who you probably know from Lost. But this guy, I actually watched a little bit of Colony and I thought it was pretty good. The ratings it gets on, you know, Metacritic or Rotten Tomatoes are not bad as well. I think it's like 84% over on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm interested to see what he can do, because that's a sci-fi show. And so this is a different arena, but he's also done, well, maybe not as much success, but he did Hercules, the movie with the Rock.
The Rock version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know about that. He was a writer and co-creator on that, or writer on that, but he's going to be co-creator and showrunner on this show.
Yeah. You know, Stephen King praised the Colony a lot. I haven't seen any of it, but he said that it was something special, smart, suspenseful, subversive, thought provoking. Yeah. And Hercules, it's not great, but like, it's also good to get those experiences, you know, like, is the building your creative muscles, you know, writing for a large project. Also, Condal had worked on a canceled fantasy Western. The filming is where he met George Martin for the first time. He's been a fan of A Song of Fire ever since A Storm of Swords was published. So he didn't get in at the very beginning, but he got in like on the second book.
I don't think you have to get in at the very beginning to have cred.
Yeah.
You can read the books after they're published and still be a fan.
Yeah. If you read the books like before the series came out, period, which was around Feast. Yeah, it was between Feast and Dance is when the series came out. You were still an early adopter of it. And I guess Martin said that Condal tried to pitch him an adaptation about the Dunkin' Egg series, but Martin held off and said, it's not quite ready for television. I haven't finished writing it.
Yeah, no, so, we'll talk about that. But yeah.
So Connell's the guy that wrote the pilot script of the series that we're eventually going to enjoy here, and also the series Bible. We've heard about that sometimes.
Okay, like, I'm glad.
The series Bible, a lot of times, is what sets the tone of the show.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what is the feel? What is the look?
It's a style guide.
Exactly. So all the other writers and everybody else can kind of like, this is the blueprint for how should things look, how should things feel, how should things sound. And I like it when series have that stuff, because it suggests there's going to be a lot of continuity and there's going to be a lot of world building and lore that feels real and it's got a history and internal cohesion to it.
Yeah.
Another executive producer, you'll recognize this name, Miguel Sapochnik, who became famous for directing all of the best action on Game of Thrones. He won an Emmy. He directed 6 episodes of Game of Thrones, including the Emmy award winning Battle of the Bastards. He also directed The Long Night, got another Emmy for that, or nominated, and also won Emmy for Best Drama Series as executive producer of Game of Thrones in the final season. So he's fantastic. He's a known quantity as well. Big Game of Thrones roots. I'm excited to see him, you know, of co-helming the series. Let's talk about the writer's room. Any interesting candidates there?
Not a lot of people that I'm super familiar with, but George Martin's former writing assistant, I don't know how to pronounce it, Ty or T. Mickel, is going to be in there in the writer's room. Also, you know, Ryan's bringing over one of his guys, too, from the Colony show. Wes Tuke, also in the writer's room. There's Charmaine DeGrate from The 100, which I have not seen.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then there's also a historical fiction and fantasy novelist, David Anthony Durham, may be coming aboard. We're not sure. It's unconfirmed right now, but that's rumored.
And he'd be great for like getting the look and feel of this feudal society, you know, getting it nailed down. We'll say that like, I was looking when I was doing the research for like names to get excited by, like, oh yeah, I've heard of that. Oh, this is going to be, these are a lot of unproven quantities, but you know, when we started with Game of Thrones, that was a lot of the case too. A lot of like, you know, if you heard Kit Harington, it's going to be Jon Stark, it'd be who, you know, a lot, you know, you had your Sean Beans, of course, you had some people that were like big names, but a lot of the people in Game of Thrones were essentially unknowns. Or had been known for very niche-y stuff that they'd done in like Irish and British film. So like, it's not necessarily the case that you know, it'd be great if you had big name writers and showrunners. But these people do have Hollywood experience with some big budget projects. So it's not like, for the Double D's, for instance, they literally had no showrunning experience, whatever, before they get thrown into the meat grinder. So hopefully we won't waste $50 million on a failed pilot, et cetera, et cetera. Rounding out the executive producer role, Vince Girardi, who executive produced all of Game of Thrones as well as the movie Jumper, which I actually got a soft spot for.
Yeah, I kind of like that movie.
I like Anakin Skywalker having another decent sci-fi movie up his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Lee Hess was also the writer producer on House and Orange is the New Black, two projects that I respect a lot.
Yep.
And Ron Schmidt, who, as far as I can tell, is a total unknown. Like his filmography thing of Game of Thrones on IMDb is essentially House of Dragon, I think.
Even his name, Ron Schmidt, just sounds like a dude, right?
He could be three kids in an overcoat. You just never know. You never know. Ron Adult Man is his name. There's a stable of directors for the first season has been tapped, including Claire Kilner, who's directed episodes of The Alienist, Angel of Darkness, The Wedding Date, which is a 2005 rom-com with Deborah Winger and Dermot Mulroney. Geeta V. Patel, which is set, I've not seen do anything, but they are tapped to do the first two episodes of season 2 of The Witcher, which I really like the first season. Yeah. And has a lot of that same kind of Game of Thrones feel good vibes and kind of like look and feel to it. So I think that's going to be a very natural fit. And then Greg Yatanez. This is tough with these names.
Yeah.
Who directed multiple episodes of Banshee and House is also coming on as both a director and co-executive producer. I love Banshee. Banshee is a really amazing action series that was on Cinemax about this sheriff who is actually like a what do they call that? A cat burglar, a high class, world class, thief, con man.
Yeah.
Who took over sheriff duties from a small town that's like ran by the Amish mafia, essentially, and just and had a small Indian reservation on it too. That factored just a really fun series. That this guy knows how to direct action. And the other thing about Banshee is it was better than it had a right to be. Like, this was just an action show, but it had a lot of like pathos and good character moments with it too. So. And then last but not least, Ramin Djawadi.
Oh, yeah. You can't do a Game of Thrones based series without him doing the compositions.
I wonder if he's going to. Are they just going to play? Are they just going to run Game of Thrones, the main theme, back? Or will there be a slight. Will it be kind of like. You know, will it be a slightly reworking of it? Will it be inspired by it all, or be a completely new score? Because, you know, if he's done a lot of different stuff, Westworld is nothing like his work on Game of Thrones.
Yeah. No, if I had to guess, it's going to have a darker tone to it. I feel like the fire and blood, right? That feeling is going to leak into most parts of this. And yeah, I expect good things, though, whatever he comes up with.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't.
In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So that's behind the cameras. What do we know about the people in front of the cameras? We talked about the backstory. We highlighted certain characters. Who's in the cast?
So we do know a few of the main roles that have been cast already. I think four or five people have been slated for like the big characters, like Rhaenyra and Viserys. I don't know how to say this guy's last name. Paddy Considine. You probably know him from like Hot Fuzz or The Third Day.
Wasn't he the twins? He was the twins in Hot Fuzz, wasn't he?
I think so. Man, it's been a while since I've seen that. But yeah, I remember liking him in that. He's been cast as King Viserys Targaryen. And you know, we kind of went over he's sort of the king at the time of the start of this whole thing, right? He's Rhaenyra's father. He's the decent guy that you were talking about who kept the land prosperous and everything. We'll see how that all goes.
Yeah, it's interesting because he's
like wording that they give in the HBO documentation is just that Viserys was chosen by the lords of Westeros to succeed the old king, Jaehaerys Targaryen, at the Grey Council of Harrenhal, a warm, kind, and decent man. Viserys only wishes to carry forward his grandfather's legacy, but as we've learned from Game of Thrones, good men do not necessarily make for great kings.
Right. We talked about the fact that this guy, you know, was fairly popular, fairly well-liked, fairly successful and prosperous, but he kind of left his hand off the switch at the end and left the country wealthy and well-provided, but inherently unstable. Yeah. It's also interesting. So I want to talk about like some background details because there's a bunch of stuff on him. We talked about him being the fifth Targaryen king. He was a dragon rider, had Balerion the Black Dread. If this happens late in his life, then Balerion's probably dead, so he won't be a dragon rider. He was a peaceful man who hated conflict and became plump and pleasant. He is described as amiable, open-handed, eager to please. He was never considered strong-willed, but he also wasn't considered pliable or indecisive, easy to manipulate. When he made a choice, he was unwavering and firmly stood by his decision. His generosity was legendary, and the Red Keep became a palace of song and splendor during his reign. He hosted countless balls, feasts, and other tournaments, and lavished golden offices and honors amongst those he favored, and as a result was well-loved by the lords and small folk alike. Probably one of the things that contributed to the Dance of Dragons, because him, even though it was not according to Hoyle, putting his daughter next in line for the throne and having all the lords and ladies, you know, do obeisance to her, they're like, well, we like this guy, we're loyal to him, he's lined her pockets with gold, let's just go with it. The curious thing I have is, like, imagine reading, like, casting information and not knowing anything about Game of Thrones, and you get to, like, Mark Eddy as Robert Baratheon. You're like, oh, he's going to be a big central figure.
Yeah.
And he dies in episode 4. Like, unless they're going to spend the whole season, like, and that might be cool, because they did cast this guy. He's solidly middle year, like late middle years. He could play a guy who's 35. He could play a guy who's 75.
Yeah, a little hair color either way.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll show like moments of him and his daughter when they're like, will the first season be like us watching Princess Rhaenyra and all become a, you know, will we see like this whole family thing play out over a season, or will there be flashbacks You know, like it will open up like John Aaron's death did in Game of Thrones, and he's just lying there dead. And we just get flashbacks of the great man he once was and the impact he had on his daughter and his wives in the realm. Because, yeah, this guy's his death is what kicks off this whole story.
Right. And I feel like there's a huge temptation to go the John Aaron route, which doesn't feel right for this because the players are so connected to him. Like John Aaron in Game of Thrones is like an outside force for all the major players of the Game of Thrones show, right? Whereas in this, he's so personally connected to the major players. You need to feel that death a lot more than you need to feel John Aaron's death, right?
Yeah, John Aaron's death is just a mystery to solve.
Exactly. You know, like this why feels more intimate, more personal. You kind of need a prelude to lead up to that. So I expect that they won't just jump right in and show, you know, obviously there wouldn't be stones on the eyes and all that.
Stones on his eyes, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do that.
But I also wonder if they'll do because play this unreliable narrator, hit the victor writes the history kind of thing and just like suggest that he was maybe poisoned. Like how much intrigue will they inject into the series to make it? Because, you know, a lot of the stuff feels very dry. He died of old age. The queen took advantage. But what if the queen had a legitimate other than just like, well, I'm not tired. My sons are trueborn heirs and I'm tired of seeing them passed over because of this, you know, blah, blah, blah. What if there's a suggestion that maybe, you know, Rhaenyra was getting nervous about these older, you know, her younger brothers are getting old and becoming, you know, men full grown. And she wanted to put it like, you know, and this
she
feels like there's
sure
some
she
treason.
Claims the throne first.
Yeah. They're like, you know, who, and that's the other thing. Like, I wonder who's going to be the good guys and the bad guys between the blacks and the greens.
Because, I mean, it would be easy for me to say the good guys are the ones who support Rhaenyra because she was appointed by the sitting
king, rightful heir,
right?
Yeah.
And is, I think, the rightful heir, but that's easy for me to say, you know?
Right. Okay, who's next?
The next casting note we have is for who's going to play Alicent or Alicent Hightower.
I think it's Alicent, yeah.
Alicent. It's Olivia Cooke. From you might recognize her from Ready Player One. She played Artemis, which is kind of the you know, main co-star there.
But she was mostly CG, so you blink if you missed her.
She was, yeah. There were moments toward the end where she revealed herself, but yeah. So HBO describes Alicent Hightower, as the daughter of Otto Hightower, the Hand of the King, and the most comely woman in the Seven Kingdoms. I'll admit here, I've never really known what comely means.
Yeah.
And just like plain.
It's a fuddy duddy. Comely means like very beautiful, I think. But it's kind of like,
oh, really?
I've always felt the same way. It's like calling a woman handsome. Like, what the fuck does that mean?
Oh. Like,
it's very old fuddy duddy type of word, I feel like. But
it is.
She's
I would
beautiful.
Never use that word in daily speech. She was raised in the Red Keep, close to the king and his innermost circle. She possesses both a courtly grace and a keen political acumen. And that is what excites me about this thing. Like,
especially since
make her a little finger, you know?
Yeah. They say that, you know, her father's Otto Hightower, the Hand of the King, he was actually the hand for three different kings over his life. So he's like this super chief of staff who knows all the ins and outs, all the connections. Like they really describe him as like this power. Obviously, he parlays his position into his daughter being the queen. And a lot of people accused him of being, like we mentioned, being heavy handed. No pun intended about that. So when I look at both of the women in this series, like I'm reminded, like these are both like political, like both of their fathers raised them to be leaders and to have this political. Imagine like a Cersei. If Tywin actually gave a shit about teaching her all of his ways.
Yeah.
You know, like both of these women are formidable and have a huge military and political followings and are going to manage these dynasties. And I think that's really cool. Some background about her is like everything I've read said that she actually was fond and got along well with her stepdaughter until she started bearing sons. And the thought of them being passed over started to really stick in her craw. So like, are they going to rewind and show us some of that, you know? We'll see. Who's next?
The next person who I'm kind of familiar with is Emma Darcy. I don't know if that's exactly how you say it, but she's going to play Rhaenyra Targaryen, which, you know, is, according to HBO, the king's firstborn child. She is pure Valyrian blood, and she is a dragon rider. It's exciting. Many would say that Rhaenyra was born with everything, but she was not born a man, which they're obviously setting up the central conflict of everything to go on here. I saw her in Truth Seekers, which is an Amazon Prime show with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, like supernatural ghost hunter type of thing. And I really liked it. I thought she was good in it, but she's not
Coronetto,
like
another Coronetto connection.
Yeah.
Hot Fuzz. Not, there's a 6 degrees of separation.
Edgar Wright part of that. Part of Truth Seekers. Maybe not, but I'm sure he's talked to them about it. But yeah, I'm interested to see what she can do in a role that requires maybe a little bit more of her, because it's the only thing I've seen her in.
So Fire and Blood paints Queen Rhaenyra as proud, stubborn, petulant, notes that she could be charming, but she's also quick to anger, was never one to forget slights. She was a fancy dresser, dressed in rich purple, maroon velvets with golden mirrorish lace. With intricate patterns. There's also a neat detail that she liked to wear many gold and silver rings. And when she was anxious, she would turn them compulsively around her fingers. I wonder, it seems like there's a lot of kind of character quirks for an actor to dig in or sink their teeth into.
Yeah.
You know, because it just paints a person as like, she seems kind of like brittle and like paranoid and suspicious with some of this stuff. And maybe for good reason, because she is never supposed to be the heir. Her father makes her the heir, and then she feels the footsteps of her brothers, you know, like growing up. Like maybe she's got good reason to be suspicious and paranoid of being replaced in this fucking feudal system that's all about Games of Thrones and such. The next name people will probably recognize. Who's up next, Jim?
People probably will, but I definitely didn't. Matt Smith is a guy who has been in The Crown. He's been a doctor in Doctor Who. He's going to be playing Prince Daemon Targaryen. HBO describes him as the younger brother of King Viserys and heir to the throne. Daemon is a peerless warrior and a dragon rider who possesses the true blood of the dragon. But it is said that whenever a Targaryen is born, the gods toss a coin in the air.
His background is, as they mentioned, he's the most experienced warrior of his time. He wields the Valyrian Steelblade Darksister, which is the sword that Aegon the Conqueror's sisters wore in the battle. He was participating in a lot of foreign wars in Essos, too.
He's the Jaime Lannister of this series.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we just had two kings of unprecedented peace in Westeros, so not a lot of battles going on there. So if you want to win glory, you got to go over to Continent next and kick some ass in Essos, which... Sure. Is a doublet, so it gives him lots of combat experience in a time where a lot of the military generals have theoretical experience. But if you want to go raise gold for an army against this guy, you got tons of rich people who are, you know, got smarting backsides of all the asses he's kicked over there in West in Essos that can throw their treasure and their cell swords into the battle. He rides a dragon. Caraxes, which is described as red, huge, and lean in battle. He was formidable, fearsome, and experienced. Daemon is described in the histories as being dashing, daring, and dangerous. He's also ambitious, impetuous, mercurial, amoral, reckless, and quick to take offense. Really pairs well with his niece here. He's also described as being charming and hot-tempered. Again, him and Rhaenyra seem very well paired here. He's got lots of combat experience, but he's also got a long list of enemies from that combat experience that might make him a liability for his side. Who we got next? By the way, I guess we should start Alicent Hightower is the green. When you hear this is like the blacks and the greens, that's the side. Rhaenyra and Prince Daemon are on the team black. the quote unquote rightful heirs, I guess. So yeah. I'll try to call those distinctions out as we go on.
So next up is Steve Toussaint, which I'm not familiar with. He has been in like an episode of Doctor Who. He's been in something called It's a Sin, which is a TV mini series. I haven't seen a lot of stuff that he's in. He was in a Prince of Persia movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. It's not a good movie.
I definitely recognize his face. He's been in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I'm sure I've seen him around, but he hasn't been like the lead in anything I've watched. So
a lot of British stuff.
He's going to be playing Lord Corlys Velaryon, aka the Sea Snake. And HBO describes him as the Lord of House Velaryon, a Velaryon bloodline as old as the House Targaryen. The Sea Snake is the most famed nautical adventurer in the history of Westeros. He's built his house into a powerful seat that is even richer than the Lannisters and that claims the largest navy in the world.
Yeah, this guy was one of my favorite characters out of Fire and Blood. He's got like the swagger of a Han Solo with the ability to sail. Like he's sailed the furthest west of anybody. He's seen more of the world than anybody. Like before he was even like 30, he had gained all this fame and he just keeps getting cooler. He's described as brilliant as he is restless, adventurous as he is ambitious, though accomplishing much and more in his life. As Martin puts it, he was seldom satisfied. He's remembered as wise in peace and valiant in war, as a really great character. Although Queen Alicent Hightower thought him arrogant, which, you know, he's on Team Black. So he's against, you'll remember that he was one of the few allies that the Princess Rhaenyra has at the beginning of the Dance of Dragons. He's also from House Velaryon, which is an old Velaryon, which is an old Velaryon house.
Oh boy!
You know,
oh,
that came from
it begins right. The mix up of names.
So Velaryon, you'll remember, was this old island continent that got exploded by dark magic and dragon bullshit, and is known as the Doom of Velaryon. And that's the Targaryens were in the last houses that escaped and came to Westeros and raised a ruckus. They are actually an older Velaryon house that settled in Westeros even before the Targaryens. And as such, they have this old kind of blood bond of allegiance to their fellow Velaryons. It's interesting because he's never physically described in the books and the research material, and they've cast a black man to play him.
Yeah.
Which I think is I think it's probably going to cause I don't know. People always get all worked up about this stupid shit. But his children are all described as classically Velaryon, you know, silver hair, purple eyes. It'll be interesting to see how they do that. But it's also you've got a lot of questionable genetic hereditary in sure. Game of Thrones. The seed is strong. Like we've talked about how that doesn't really fucking make any sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, so yeah, I don't know. I think this guy seems very cool, and I want to see how well he does as a Sea Snake here.
I'm not trying to make the comparison to like one of the very few other black actors in Game of Thrones, the series, uh-huh. but he strikes me as like a Salador San type of guy. Like he's you know, floating around the yeah. oceans. He's got this like adventurer streak, the swagger, the wisdom, the
right.
Yeah,
I wonder. Yeah. Like it'd be a fun detail if they somehow connected the lines that it turns out that Salador was some kind of like great 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 grand bastard of the Sea Snake. You know, yeah, like that's how he got all of his piratical prowess. That'd be kind of cool. Who else we got?
The next one up is Eve Best, who's known for probably Nurse Jackie in The King's Speech the most. She's going to be playing Princess Rhaenys Velaryon, who is a dragon rider and wife to Lord Corlys Velaryon. The queen who never was, is what they call her, I guess, was passed over as heir to the throne at the Great Council because the realm favored her cousin, Viserys, simply for being male.
Yeah, we talked about all the precedents that this violated, making the female heir the heir. And this is a big, like, she literally, the first generation before, or the generation, her generation, she was skipped over. So you can imagine seeing like that sticking in her craw, you know, and being maybe very supportive of the first female queen. They described Rhaenys as being a great beauty, clever, capable, spirited, proud, fierce, and fearless, the fiery temperament, and she wore in a battle a steel and copper armor which flashed in the sun. Seems to be pretty visually spectacular, and another strong sword arm, and I believe Dragon Rider. In the black, because that's the thing that the blacks got over the greens. They got tons of dragons and experienced dragon riders. Mm-hmm. So that should be fun. And also these names, man, Rhaenys,
oh god,
Rhaenyra, you know, like I think I've already fucked up Rhaenyra. I call it Rhaenyris. Like, yeah,
sure.
Rhaenys, Rhaenyra, Rhaenyris. It's there's a lot of this. Yeah.
Bran
Targaryens. Goddamn Targaryens.
Yeah. Well, it's not just that. It's goddamn Martins.
All right. Who's next?
Next up is, oh boy, even the actors are going to get on the name confusion. Rhys Ifans, Ifans. I don't know. He's from Notting Hill, the Amazing Spider-Man. He's going to be playing Otto Hightower, the Hand of the King, who loyally and faithfully serves both his king and his realm. As the Hand sees it, the greatest threat to the realm is the king's brother, Daemon, and his position as heir to the throne.
Yeah, he's considered a man of great learning, very well educated, but also that education's made him kind of haughty, blunt, and domineering. He's known as being very methodical. Again, he was the Hand to three different kings. He was also dismissed from service by two of those kings, so... He kind of had a habit of overreaching as Hand and getting smacked down and trying again and again. So he's a very interesting, complicated character, and I'm curious to see what they end up doing with him here.
Next up is one I'm excited about because yes. I've seen her in several things, including Ex Machina and Devs. She's also in Crazy Rich Asians. Sonoya Mizuno, she's signed on as Masaria. And she came to Westeros with nothing, sold more times than she can recall, and could have wilted, but instead she rose to become the most trusted and most unlikely ally of Prince Daemon Targaryen, the heir to the throne.
Yeah, her name's Lady Masaria, also called Lady Misery. She was a dancer from Lys, like a pleasure girl, that became the paramour of Prince Daemon Targaryen, an unofficial mistress of Whisperers to Queen Rhaenyra Targaryen. So she's kind of like a Varys figure. She was the one of the leads on the Devs, and she was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And she kind of has this era of mystery and intrigue. And like, she says little, but thinks much. Like I can really see her in this role. It's going to be, I think she's going to do. And also she's one of the few people I've actually had real experience with. Yeah, it's like her and the dude from Hot Fuzz are the ones that I'm like, yeah, I've seen him and stuff. So I'm excited to see her. But again, it doesn't really bother me that a lot of these people are not well known, because that's essentially the entire cast outside of like Sean Bean and Mark Eddy from the original cast. Like
Charles Dance.
Yeah. But like most of it was like unknown people. And that's good, because it allows you to start with a blank slate. You don't have a bunch of preconceived notions of their character and whatnot.
Sure. How about Fabian Frankel? Are you familiar with him?
Oh, this is the one that Martin just slipped on his not a blog last week. Like this, we were literally writing the outline and we got new surprise casting news. I am not familiar with this guy.
OK, I'm not either. I don't think anybody really would be. He's pretty new to acting, as far as I can tell. He's been in a couple of... he started to move into leading roles more and more, and it seems like this is going to just, you know, take his career through the roof, because he's already headed that direction anyway. But he's going to be playing Sir Criston Cole, and he's common-born son of the steward of the Lord of Blackhaven. He has no claims to lands or titles. That sounds pretty familiar. All he has is honor and his skill with sword and lance. He's a challenger, a champion, cheered by the commons, beloved of the ladies. He is a lover, or is he? A seducer, or is he? A betrayer, or is he? A breaker of hearts and a maker of kings.
Yeah, so this is right. That's a quote right from George Martin's blog. And you're like, oh, this is a lot of double talk. But this is, again, this is where a lot of the mystery of the Fire and Blood comes from, because it's a... it's an after the fact history where one maester is collecting all the history. And he's like, you know, a lot of times he'll say maester and so and so holds that such and such happened, while maester what's his face held the that this actually is the true. And then every once in a while he would cite this figure called Mushroom, who we're going to talk about here in a minute, who was the court jester for this period of the Targaryens. And he almost always injected the most ribald, sexual, lustful thing that could possibly happen. Like, that's where a lot of like the really, yeah, he really, really sexes things up and is very crude. So there's like, you know, this Sir Criston Cole, who is the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard at this time, used to be a staunch defender of Queen Rhaenyra. And later was the one who stabbed the Master of Coins that tried to storm out of the small council meeting that was trying to usurp the crown from that same princess. Why did he switch allegiances?
Yeah.
And there's a, this is where Maester is like, is he this or is he? Is he this? Because a lot of Maesters will say, well, it's probably this or it's probably that. He might have felt jilted. Mushroom has got the whole like, well, he's actually upset that Prince Daemon was fucking his niece and didn't, you know, like,
up everybody's skirts. Yeah, this is what I love. You should be feeling right now as we're talking about the is he. And you think back to like Jaime Lannister, right? Oh, he's the Kingslayer.
Yeah.
Is he? Why is he? You know, all these components of Game of Thrones feel like they're there, which is the most exciting thing about all of this news that's coming out, is I feel like they're going to really nail the things that I loved about that first series.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of like the Next Generation when you're like, oh, Data. Oh, he's like the Spock. You know, like this Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, Criston, he seems like he's got the humble beginnings and ambitions of a Littlefinger, but the good looks, lady killer, swordsmanship of Jaime Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine that, like, that's like a total fucking package, right?
Yeah.
And he's, you know, all he just needs is someone to scheme and he'd have the full package. So I'm excited about that. And again, this is the, you know, the whole, you don't really know the whole story, which keeps this very mysterious and where they could do some interesting, exciting things with the plot. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about this Mushroom character because he has been cast, but like he's a dwarf who served as the fool to the courts of Viserys, Aegon the Second, Rhaenyra, and Aegon the Third. You know, so four generations of Targaryens. He's allegedly recorded the events that occurred during his time at their courts in the Testimony of the Mushroom, written by an unknown scribe. His tales are filled with tales of plots, murders, trysts, debaucheries, and many other salacious claims. The fool's account is frequently cited by Maester Galadin in his Targaryen history, which is what became Fire and Blood. So, yeah, I'm interested in seeing, you know, and I think it would be cool if as a framing device, there's no way. But as a framing device, it'd be pretty cool to bring Peter Dinklage back to just play this kind of like the public image of Tyrion as the drunken, sex crazed imp. Like, just lean fully into that. He's like the crypt keeper. Imagine like every at the beginning of every episode, he's like, you know, he's got his chalice of wine and he's in old age makeup and he's, you know, and he's like, let me tell you about the true history of. I think that would be cool. But also, how the fuck do you get him? How do you get Dinklage to come back to Game of Thrones again?
Sure.
And I don't play this very silly character. Like, I feel like they got to cast this guy. He gets mentioned all the fucking time in Fire and Blood. He is the court fool for all of these various characters. They're central figures. It'd be a neat nod to like, you know, like Tyrion's role in the later histories of a little man casting a large shadow. I think it'd be cool, but I don't know. That's like really fan service bullshit casting.
And I would say like, oh, there's absolutely no way they bring Peter Dinklage back to play this character in any capacity, whether it's voiceover narration or whether it's, you know, him appearing on screen. But Game of Thrones has done some weird casting stuff in the past. You know, they recast the Mountain 600 times.
It's true.
They are not opposed to doing things that seem like, oh, you can't do that. that doesn't make any sense. So who knows? Who knows? But yeah, I'd like to see that character. Sounds fun.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So let's talk about what's actually happening. Like, this is all the behind the scenes, the casting, the backstory. What is the state of production? What's happening right now?
It's in production. I think this month it started actually filming over in England. They're kind of moving because a lot of the filming took place, I think, in like Ireland, right? Or is it Scotland?
Mm-hmm. I think that's where it isn't. I thought it was Scotland where they filmed a lot of the Dragonstone places, like the cliffs and whatnot.
Oh, it's Ireland. Yeah. They, and a lot of like Spanish filming too in Spain. Because
that's where, because like a lot of this is going to take place in King's Landing and Dragonstone, which are established locations, and they're probably going to continue using them.
Right. So it seems like now that Warner and HBO are teamed up here on this, they're going to be moving production studios over to England. So a lot of this filming is going to be taking place there, especially like this Dragonstone stuff that used to be shot in Ireland and in Spain is now going to move there. They're shooting for a 2022 release on this. So I don't have any more detailed information. Does that mean late 2022, early 2022? I'm assuming mid to late is probably what we can expect.
Yeah, but you never know. I mean, this is early. They do 3-4 months of primary filming. They do 3-4 months of post-production.
And depending on the story, you know, they might not need a ton of effects work.
True. And spring was the traditional kind of kickoff for Game of Thrones. Like, I think 1 year it slipped to July. But either of those I could see. Like, late, I don't know. Do you think late 2022? I think HBO is eager to get this back on the air.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They keep sending me emails telling me to do my rewatch of Game of Thrones. So they're eager to make something happen with it.
It's the Iron Anniversary. It's the 10th anniversary of Game of Thrones debuting just like a couple weeks ago. So, yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah, we've been doing this a long fucking time, Jim, it turns out.
Yeah, but as you can guess, with Rhaenyra's having this as our home base, it's going to be set largely in Dragonstone. So look for a lot of those locations.
Yeah, there's a cool quote from Ryan Condal, the showrunner on the Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of podcast. He's talking about the swords and how he loves swords and like the making of them. And he alludes that there's these very famous swords like Blackfyre and Dark Sister. And he says that they're going to bring a very specific designer that does this kind of stuff professionally, does museum recreations of existing swords. He's designing when a lot of people think they're talking about Blackfyre and Dark Sister. We talked about Dark Sister, which is the sword wielded by Aegon the Conqueror's sister, Visenya. At that time, you know, Prince Daemon is the one that possesses that. And Blackfyre, which was the main battle sword, broadsword of Aegon the Conqueror, gets passed down to this Aegon the Second character on the Green Party. So you've got, you know, it's not only Targaryen versus Targaryen, but their ancestral swords are being wielded by opposite sides of the battle, too. So that's going to be cool because, like, there's a lot of lore and mystery behind these swords that informs our understanding of, like, the Blackfyre Rebellion and even was a big part of theory crafting. Because, like, if you'll remember, like, one of the cooler stories of, like, why Varys was trying to support this one Targaryen over the other is because like this, you know, this guy named Bittersteel went across after the Blackfyre Rebellion and founded the Golden Company. And legend said that he had Blackfyre and he was saving it for the true heir to the Targaryen throne, and that this was going to be some kind of false dragon in opposition to Dan. All that shit got thrown out the window in the final season of Game of Thrones. But I'm wondering if there's going to be some hints into some of that history that will allow us to be more informed of, you know, the current season. Because that's always the greatest. Like, if this is an entertaining story in its own right, and if it can deepen our appreciation of the existing material, it's a win-win.
Sure.
So we've talked about a lot of like cautious optimism and why we're looking forward to this new series. But let's talk about some meta stuff, because I think the biggest question, we get asked this all the time: do we think the prequels are going to be able to recapture the glory years of Game of Thrones, like the core, like season one through season four, or maybe five and six, if you want to, like, people have different times of when the show kind of fell off a cliff or started losing some wheels on the wagon. But like season one through four, you know, I guess prime Game of Thrones. What do you think?
It depends on what you mean by recapture the glory. Are you talking about the amount of people watching it? Are you talking about the quality of the storytelling?
Yes.
The excitement in the fandom. You're talking about all of it? Holy shit.
Oh, the whole thing. Yeah.
I don't know if it can recapture that. Like, TV is so fragmented now, and I know this is going to be big, but also a lot of people were disappointed by the end of season eight, particularly. Are you going to get all those people back eventually? You know, can you give it a season or two and everybody says, oh, this is the best thing on television again. You got to come back. It's, you know, a new story, new creators, none of this double D's bullet point bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you get there a few seasons in, but you're not going to get there right away. There are a lot of people who feel burned by Game of Thrones.
That's true, but like, it was commonly said that 100 million people were watching Game of Thrones worldwide at the beginning of season eight. And I find it very hard to believe that 50% of those people won't come in for, especially the pilot episode, but for more generally the first season. And if it's good, I think it's going to retain that base. And then like people that were the other 50 million that are kind of like, yeah, fuck Game of Thrones, might start coming back to the fold. On the other hand, if this is seen as like aggressively average, I think you're going to see that 50 million rapidly erode. And the other thing is, like, Game of Thrones brought a lot of people to the fantasy table.
Yeah, like Jim Jones, me included.
Like, I remember Bill Simmons, like, I used to listen to him a lot, and he's like, I don't watch these walking through the woods things. And then around season three, the Red Wedding brought him in, and the thing is the Game of Thrones slow burnt.
Yeah.
That Dungeons and Dragons shit, right? Like, you didn't get to, you got dragons at the end of the first season, but like, there was no hint of really any kind of magic. It was just all like, you know, House of Cards feudal system.
Well, they started with
this is not White that Walker,
but yeah,
I guess that's true. You start with like a monster mystery in the cold open, but then they never get back to that until like Dany's dragons are born at the end of season one. So you got all, you know, 10 hours of television to win people over with your sex position and your intricate plotting and your scheming and all that kind of stuff. This is not that. This is, you got dragons flying in the air. You got pyromancers. You got, you know, exotic women from Lys doing spells and shit. Like, this is going to be very fantasy in your face right away.
Oh, boy. Don't say that, like, man, because now that started to turn me off. They got me, right? So they slow burned me enough that now I'm in. And if they can keep enough political intrigue, enough scheming, enough of the more grounded stuff in there, even if there are dragons in every other scene, I think I'm going to stick with it. I think I'm going to be okay.
But that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. Like, this has to be good TV. This has to be 8 out of not 10 or better. If this is a bunch of 5 out of 10, 6 out of 10 stuff, like, everybody, I think, is going to rapidly lose interest, and you're going to be left with the diehards. You're going to, I think that's the thing. Like, this could be a monster show just because 10%, let's say 10% of the diehards, like the people that think that had no issue with season 8 of Game of Thrones. That's 10 million people. That's a lot of people watching this show. So like, yeah, it's like, but like, again, like I really, man, another universe, season 8 went a different way. And this is like, this is the most hotly anticipated show of all time. It's crazy. If you went back 5 years and said that, like, there'd be tepid interest of the prequels to Game of Thrones, you would not believe it.
Yeah.
It'd be like tepid interest in the next Marvel property, you know, like, but here we are. Do you think this has any impact on Martin finishing his goddamn books?
Ugh. I don't know, man.
Cause he's now like, he's won the co-creator, executive producer, like he's working on the show in some capacity.
I mean, he's always been working on other things. That's been part of the problem, right?
I know.
He just That's needs exactly to sit down and write the fucking books, which we've been saying for years now. I don't think this is going to help or hurt. It's like, and who knows how involved he's going to be, right? I mean, he's
right.
a co-executive producer. It's not like he's the showrunner. It's not like he
right.
has to be there every single day, keeping things on track. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of input, but can he continue to do other things in the meantime?
Yeah, is he like Probably. The executive producer in the same way that the Coen brothers are executive producers on Fargo, in which they just
J.J. Abrams
essentially...
is an executive producer on everything?
Yeah. Yeah, they just cash checks and right. Nod every once in a while and are kind of aware of what you're doing, or that is he actually going to, because in the first few seasons, Martin wrote episodes, he broke the scripts, he did, like, he was intimately involved mm-hmm. until like the show started overtaking him. I will say that for the first time in 3 years, he started making definite concrete statements about making significant progress on Winds of Winter and all that kind of stuff. But shit, 6 years ago, he was reading chapters at conventions, right. preview chapters. So like, I just don't know. And if like, maybe the fact that the public cooled off on Game of Thrones and like gave him some mental space to kind of like work on it. But like, if this is good, like, let's say he gets Winds out and it's seen as like 9 out of 10, like better than Dance, a clear improvement over, like, because a lot of people think that Dance and Feast are kind of like plodding and slow and not as exciting as the first three novels.
Yeah.
But there, it's the middle part. It's a set piece. You're moving towards the grand climax. If Winds comes out and it's amazing, and this series comes out and it's amazing, I wonder if the same distraction engine that sapped his creative energy for years and years will start up again and we'll just never get,
and it's,
you know, Dream of Spring.
It's pretty clear also that some of his attention has turned, his interest has turned to the Fire and Blood, right? Like, between writing yeah. that history and starting this show, this being the show that he pitched first, right? He's clearly,
right.
this is where
and
his
he's
mind
done with
is.
This. He's done. He wrote this, like, you know, like, the
well, there's
scale,
that second volume, isn't there? Is he
well,
done
but it
with
has,
that?
It isn't. But like the Dance of Dragons is done at the end of Fire and Blood. So like all the major, oh, okay. like we okay. know, like, and then they can take liberties with it. But like, we know the main beats, like it'd be like writing a movie about World War II, like, you know, Hitler's going to get beat, you know, the Emperor of Japan's going to get defeated, you know, there's going to be a bombing in Dresden, there's going to be 2 atomic bombs dropped, you know, there's going to be a yeah. landing in Normandy, but there's still a lot of places to tell those stories, right? Mm-hmm. I just don't know, guys. I can't figure out Martin. He's kind of a weird guy.
I don't know, man.
What He's... motivates him, what inspires him.
Yeah. I don't know. He clearly doesn't seem to be motivated by mortality, which
yeah.
is what worries me about him. But
because the thing is like, I do think that Game of Thrones, the property, was pretty mishandled in the last season or two. And best case scenario to get this thing back on track is if Martin finishes his books and people like, oh, even if Bran's king, like, oh, this is a way more cooler and believable than it happened. And because like I think yeah. that the still Game of Thrones always looked amazing and the mm-hmm. characters were iconic. And if you just had like, if I read the book, I would be very easy to see Emilia Clarke and Kit Harington in those roles and kind of like almost rewrite the last season in my own mind. And like it would raise it. Its estimation would go up in my mind's eye. And then you get House of Dragons and it's amazing, like suddenly Game of Thrones is I could even see, we've talked about this a couple times, like if I'm HBO and Martin finishes these books, who says no to just redoing the last three seasons of Game of Thrones? Let's call it, like, I don't know, Game of Thrones, what actually, I don't know what you would call it. Game of Thrones Revisited, Game of, like, you know, the Zack Snyder, and we've got instances, right, this, like, right, the Zack Snyder cut.
True.
Where Warner Brothers spent, what, $50 to $75 million to reshoot and rescore and do all this stuff for this 4-hour fucking version. And, you know, Warner Brothers and HBO are in bed now. Yeah. Like, that's money just to leave it on the table. If you don't do it, you got the rights to it. Like, I think that would really just, then Game of Thrones is back to being the just juggernaut again.
It's just, but the, man, weird tone that so they much take in their emails. Like, yeah. I talked about these emails that I've been getting. It's like, start your rewatch of the greatest show in the history of television. No one has ever, right, complained about this show on the, right, internet or face to face in person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing's wrong with it. That's the tone that I get from HBO, but which of course they would have to have that tone, right? They can't say, yeah, we made a giant piece of shit, uh-huh, and please don't watch it. Like,
we had two guys who were underqualified and bored at the end and run out of material, right, and we just let them run this thing into the ground and destroy all this goodwill and momentum. And again, I know there are people who admire, there's people that I respect, like Kim Renfro is still always carrying a torch for Game of Thrones, and I obviously respect her and her opinion. I just think that the majority of us were burnt.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we weren't unbowed, unburnt, unbroken. We were the opposite of all those things. We were not the Dornish. We were the, I don't know. We were the Harrenhals. It just got burnt on a castle at the end of this thing.
Not seeing it. But
every time I talk about this in the public thing, I get several people in my mentions being like, you know, fucked it. I don't believe that.
No, I would watch it in a heartbeat. For sure.
Yeah. If nothing else, just for schadenfreude. Like, I want to see if they can fuck it up even. But yeah, there's going to be massive interest in this first season. And there's so much pressure on these people. Then some of them don't have a lot of proven track record. I hope they can pull it off, man. I really do. I'm rooting for them.
In our yearly award show, we have a category called highest risk, highest reward. And that would certainly make the cut. You're talking, we're going to go back and do potentially three seasons of the end of this show again. What, mm-hmm, if they suck more? What if people hate them more? Mm. That's a big risk, man, you're taking.
Yeah, sure is. So we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. We got probably a year, maybe 18 months or so, somewhere between 12 and 18 months. We will be consuming this product and seeing how it goes. So, starting next week, we're going to flip the keys back to Anthony, Maester Anthony, who's going to continue his Electric Boogaloo. If you weren't aware that he does a weekly show where he's going through a chapter by chapter book club of Game of Thrones, going to continue doing that. He takes a break every 10 episodes or so, takes a couple weeks off, and we're going to come in those gaps going forward, and we're going to start doing little miniature roundups. This is going to end up being about an hour and a half long. But we're going to catch up the casting news. We're going to see if there's any leaks from the sets. We're going to try to figure out what's going on at this show. So every couple months, we're going to be updating this. So stay subscribed. And then again, when House of Dragons finally lands, it's going to be right here. It's, mm-hmm, going to be ground zero. So keep the feed warm and ready.
Yeah, let the dragon fire assist you with that.
Is that it?
That's it, man.
I thought we rounded this up pretty well. Pretty good preview. We'll be back in a couple of months with another installment. Please enjoy the Electric Boogaloo in the meantime. It's good to talk about Game of Thrones again. Hoping for a dream of a successful franchise going forward. Because I really want to love this thing.
Yeah,
we'll
me
see
too.
How it goes.
I'm excited about it.
All right. See you in a couple months. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later, everybody.